We're basically kind of segueing. We've been talking about the authority of a Dayan Yochid Mumcha, of somebody who is uniquely qualified such that he's able to adjudicate by himself. And we're trying to figure out what exactly are the implications of that. He can be done in every sense of the word. So it's not so clear if that's actually true. Most notably, we spent some time talking about the Rambam, that the Rambam maintains that a hodah in front of a single dayan is not going to count as a hodah. And that has some technical difficulties to it. And we noted some other possible questions which could be connected to that. And the Sefer Chokhmah Mishpat, which is written by Yehuda Gershoni, who's a fascinating figure in general, and who wrote a number of svarim, Filam Sachim, he wrote the Shita Mekubetza, Sam Sachim, and a few other notable svarim. So he wrote a few volumes on the Rambam in various areas. So he has the Sefer on Hilchos Sanhedrin and the Rambam, Chokhmah Mishpat, where he talks specifically about this position of the Rambam, and he notes various difficulties. He quotes the Maharit, for example, who suggests that maybe we have to narrow the scope of the Rambam's position. He says the idea that a hodah in front of this one dayan doesn't have any significance to it at all. So, for example, the party who would make a confession, who would make some kind of acknowledgement in front of this dayan, he can then just change his mind and totally deny it. He says, hard to believe we could go that far. And he points out that why is it in general that if we want the hodah to be significant, that it has to happen in front of a bezdin? Why don't we say that any time somebody says something, so it's this week's parsha, Midvar Sheker Tirchok, so let's hold them to it. You know, why should we assume that it has to be said in the bezdin in order to be halachically significant? So he quotes the suggestion here, which ultimately he's not sure is sustainable, but that he assumes, the Maharit, that to say the acknowledgement doesn't count for anything is difficult, because the Gemara in Bava Basra explains that the idea, in the third parak, in Cheskes Avatim, explains that the idea that you need a hodah in front of Bezdin, that's only something that reflects a certain reality, that since you're in litigation with somebody, so people have a tendency not to want to tip their hands beforehand. So there is a reason why people might not be fully forthcoming until they actually reach their din Torah. Or, as some of the Rishonim understand, maybe some people will be the opposite. Maybe people will intentionally put some misinformation out there so that their opponents don't know fully what it is that they plan on saying. So until somebody actually is in front of their bezdin, in front of their din Torah, so there's a reason to believe, is what we would call, I guess, an amasla, that there is a sustainable alibi, so to speak, a sustainable belief that somebody might be saying something that's incorrect and there's a reason for it. We find in halacha, sometimes if somebody wants to change his mind, so we believe you, when you change your mind, if you can give a good reason why you would have been misleading the first time around. So here, you have such a case. You have the fact that people who are waiting to have their day in court don't want to tip their hand too early, so they may intentionally say things that are misleading in order to confuse the other party. But that's only true until they're actually in their process of din Torah. So then what they say is going to have significance. It's going to have the significance that it should always have. So therefore, the Maharit assumes that you have to say that what people say in front of this Dayan Yachid should be considered meaningful. And that he assumes that there must be that this idea that's not considered a hodah is only for certain other very limited purposes. Is only, so for example, to consider this as if it was written b'shtar, and the Gemara says that a hodah made in front of the three dayanim has the significance like it was written in a shtar, okay, we won't go that far. But to say that you can just disregard it completely, and you can just go back on it because it's as if nothing happened, you thought that was going too far, and there were other approaches as well to try to limit the scope of what the Rambam writes. But ultimately, he says it's hard to sustain that from the language of the Rambam. He notes here also that if you look at the Rambam, when he talks about the obligation to have a courts system in various places, so he quotes here, for example, if you look in the Rambam, in Parak Aleph, Halach Adalah. So he writes, Yir she'ein ba me'ev esrim, if you have a smaller city, it doesn't have 120 people, ma'midin ba shlosha dayanim, she'ein bezdin pachos mishlosha, because there's no such thing as a bezdin less than three. Again, if you want to look this up, that's in Parak Aleph, Halach Adalah. It's another thing that could have been in the Rambam. And he notes also that a similar statement can be found in the Rambam in Sefer HaMitzvos in Kuf Ayin Vav, where he says, "V'yirish anshe abu'atim she'ein ru'iyo sanhedri ketana yismanu bo shlosha la'asos adinim haketanim." If you have a very small little village that doesn't have enough to sustain a real substantial sanhedrin of its own, so still you should make sure to at least have a panel of three to take care of little things. So, what do you see from there? Right? Why didn't the Rambam just say, have your local posek take care of all of these smaller issues? So, what seems to be, as he notes here, that we spent some time at the beginning of last semester talking about the mitzvah of minui shoftim, minui dayanim, the obligation of Torah. We happened to be synergy that week. It was Parsha Shoftim when we started last semester. Parsha Shoftim begins, Shoftim v'shoftim titein lecha, that you have an obligation in the Torah to have a standing court system. So to have, let's say, Yochid Mumcha be the local authority, that's not going to qualify. That the requirement to have a bezdin really requires that you have more, and it's not called a bezdin if it's less than three. That's not going to satisfy that goal. He also notes here that he gets into this discussion of what we talked about the Mishnah Novos, about not to be don yichidi, she'ein don yichidi ala echad. So, just as a kind of a cap off to that discussion, so we noted that the Mishnah seems to be saying that it's not right to adjudicate by yourself, because only a Kadosh Baruch Hu does that. So, that's not the only interpretation of the Mishnah. The Mishnah doesn't actually mention God. It says, Ein don yichidi ela echad. So there are other interpretations. So for example, Rabbeinu Yonah, Tashbetz quotes this, Rabbeinu Yonah writes that it means that we're talking about humans here. We're saying that there is a type of person who could be done by himself. Who is that? A yachid mumcha. So only a certain type of person could be done by himself. But if you're going to start doing that, so you're essentially stating that that's who you are. You're basically aggrandizing yourself. You're taking a certain status on for yourself. So that's generally not advisable. And then Ben Yonah also says that the point basically is that even if that is who you are, you should bring other people with you. So he just closes off here, so we'll just mention this. Quotes from the Sefer Yad HaMelech, who has a very unusual interpretation of this whole idea. But it's worth mentioning as kind of a perspective on the whole process of din. It's a whole different interpretation. So I'll read it to you. That he writes, "Huderach nesinas tam, mepnei ma anu mizharim lebal niya dani yichidi." This is to give us a reason why we should not adjudicate by ourselves. Mishum detchuna shel hadani yichidi tzarech das hadayin liyais echad. That the requirement, the nature of someone who's going to judge by himself, is that his attitude, his mind, has to be complete and undivided. The hainu at study din, srichin lios kol kacha chodin viado. That the different components of the question have to be unified into one answer. Ad shlo yala bedaito klal, shiesh badin shnei tzadim l'schus v'lachov. That he shouldn't even think that there's a different perspective to take, that it could be the other way. Because if it would occur to him the different positions to take here, it's a fascinating idea about the mental process, he says. That if you're just one dying, so if it's an issue with two sides, so then it means that whatever side was wrong may have come to you first, and that was your initial thought. Daha yafshi yeshne yafdadim zaka yeshne mechayev. Well, kol panin daito muta mitzad echad. So his mind, his thinking, was somehow compromised at the initial process. Yal korcho tzarech b'achlatas dino lusmoch acharaso shemechriya b'daito ezem yeshne yafdadim zaka. Then he's got to go through a process to let one of the two sides win in his mind. Which one is right, which one is wrong? And that process of decision itself is going to bias things, is going to set things off course in terms of the scales within his mind. The Kol Moznei said that Trichim Shnei Tzadim Mishkol Siyos Vishivim Smitzemus Kol Kach If you're going to balance things, you're going to have to be completely objective. And that's not going to happen anymore because whatever occurred to you first is going to dominate. Fascinating perspective. So Al-Kain, Kol Shofet, Hadon Yechidi, Tzarech Lilais Echa. So anyone who's going to presume to judge by himself has to be singular. He has to be able to adjudicate with an absolute simple approach. Asher take it for Ishisa, Eina Rakdea Achas. From the very beginning, he has one understanding of how this is going. Avaloba Hachros Dea Achas Mishne Deis. But not in terms of taking one of the two opinions and deciding that that one ends up winning. Mashein came a Bezdin Shal Shlosha, which is not the case when you have a Bezdin of three. Dimdas Hashnaim is Nagdim Zelo Zeh. If two are opposing each other, two of the three Dayanim, so then one of them has the right idea. Then the Torah tells us that the majority wins, so the third dying will be machria. So then it comes out that really one individual cannot actually have a true adjudication process. That no creation has such a simple approach to things. And only the Kadosh Baruch Hu can see things in such a unified way that he's going to follow the correct approach exclusively. So therefore, this type of approach, this type of quality of Dan Yechidi, the Mishnah is talking about, only a Kadosh Baruch Hu could do this. Only he could have that kind of a mentality, so to speak, that would work. The meaning is not like the Bar Mira said, one in the world meaning God. Rather, it's about the number one, saying that one who is going to judge by himself has to have such a straightforward attitude that it's not really plausible that that's going to work, and that's going to be a chisaron of anyone judging by himself. Okay, fascinating approach, certainly not the pashut pshat, even within the implications as far as how it then works, but I thought it was interesting to share. Yes, sir?
So did we answer the questions on the Rava? How do we understand?
No, not really. I mean, basically, it seems like there's some room to debate what he actually means. There is some argument how far he's willing to go. But on the surface, it seems like he's saying that Hodah doesn't actually count, and others disagree. And certainly for the other implications, we saw others disagreeing as well. But we've also seen that some of this goes to the question of Kfiyah, and in that case, Kabbalah, acceptance by the parties, makes a big difference. So we know that we talked about Kabbalah, not new mysticism, but we talked about Kabbalah in terms of accepting the Dayanim. We talked about that, whether that mitigates the criticism in Pirkei Avos that you shouldn't be done by yourself. But now we know that our Gemara directly addresses it in another context, which we're going to now start, we'll say, a little bit of an introduction to, and we'll have to continue next time. But what's the major ramification of Kabbalah in our Gemara? What impact does it have?
Whether you have to, the judge who errs has to pay.
Okay, so if you have to pay, if you make a mistake. So this question, essentially, judicial malpractice. Now, here you have a professional, essentially, who's carrying out a job. And let's say the job is done in a way that causes a problem, that causes a loss to somebody. So to what extent should that professional be considered liable? So this also has some major synergy to this week's parasha in an additional way. You've got to look for synergy wherever you can find it. But let's, before going into what the Rishonim say, so let's think about this question. So what should the rule be? You're a professional. You're a doctor. You're a lawyer. You're an investment advisor. You're a dayan. You're carrying out your job. And the result is that somebody else takes a loss. A physical loss, a monetary loss. Are you responsible? Are you not responsible? Are you halfway responsible? Does it depend on circumstances? What would you think should make a difference here? What would you think should fit in? Are you?
Negligence.
Negligence. Okay, so maybe we should say that if there is something we can identify as negligent behavior, then there should be responsibility. But what you're implying then is what?
Normally, if he did his job, he has the right to...
So you're basically saying, by implication, is that if there's no negligence, that if the professional is carrying out the job the way he would be expected to in any other circumstance, and it just happens to be that, unfortunately, there is still a loss to the client, you should be exempt. That's essentially what you're maintaining by implication. Jed?
If the patient accepts the professional, regardless of whether he does a good job or not, whether he makes a mistake or not.
Okay, so it sounds a little like you're influenced by the Gemara in saying that, but you would say that, let's say, in terms of the doctor? Is that what you use
that as? Yeah, the doctor, if he says, whatever job you do, no matter what, I'll accept.
Okay, see, that's also interesting because that has major implications for your life. You know, that people who, let's say, happen to be EMTs or other kinds of trained individuals, when they pass by an accident scene, so nowadays they're increasingly nervous about getting involved because they could end up getting sued if they either are not as successful as they want to be, or maybe even if they are successful, they still sometimes find themselves getting sued. So are you suggesting that perhaps there's a difference between, let's say, a doctor, when it's possible for a patient to, on their own 2 feet, come to a doctor and sign a waiver and say, I trust you, whatever happens, happens, and let's say a situation like we just described, where somebody, an ENT or anybody in between, discovers an accident scene, jumps in, and then should he be more liable for whatever happened than the doctor in the first scenario? Is that what you're identifying?
I guess it would depend on whether or not he's the only one that was capable at the time of helping him.
But let's say he is. So then where does that room for acceptance fit in?
I think so.
But let's say he is, right? Let's say he's the only person qualified. But the patient's not actively accepting him under those circumstances. So what would you say then? Should, is that
if you assume it's good for him and that you're trying to, that if you do help him and succeed, then it's going to be something that's valuable for him, then yes. And then if it's something that's like, you know, doesn't really make so much of a difference whether he helps him or not, it would be good for him if it happens. But if he did do it, it would be a difference. Then,
okay, but you hear what you're saying. You're identifying something else now.
Yeah.
Which might be fine. It might be saying that there are two criteria to look at. And they might be independent of each other. And that actually may very much be a part of our sugya here. That basically you're saying that if the patient comes willingly, signs a waiver, comes to the doctor's office and says, I'm putting myself in your hands, I'm accepting the surgery, so then whatever happens, happens. And if that's not possible, the EMT happens upon an accident and the person in danger doesn't have the ability to actively choose him, as the doctor or sign any waivers before he gets rescued from the burning car. So then, there's a different reason, you're saying, that you popped in. That because this is the best available option to do something which is a clear and unquestionable good, so then that also exempts you. So you're saying two different things. Acceptance, and also when somebody is acting without acceptance but in a circumstance where this is a clear and identifiable good. How would you... We know that acceptance is a halakhic principle because that comes up in our Gemara overtly. But And what Arya mentioned in terms of Pshia as a Mechayiv, we know also exists in halachic literature for sure. So if you wanted to use halachic terminology to identify what you just said, how would you do that? Are you just being Mechayiv or something? You're saying that in general, the laws of Nezikin, that anybody who's trying very hard to help someone else and there's no one else who can do it is Pater. Is that a rule? Is that a... And obviously it makes sense. I said, like, where would we ground that within halachic thinking?
I mean, I was thinking along the lines that you can, like, acquire something for someone if it's good for them.
Okay. So let's think that through. So we know that we have a principle of Zachem Adam Shalem B'Fana, which is a little bit of a complex principle. We have to figure out exactly how it works. But that we know that you can make decisions on behalf of other people sometimes. Right? So you could say that I'm not allowed, a person wants to buy something or sell something, you need their cooperation. Otherwise, how does it transfer? So if somebody wants to give away something, they have to decide to do so on their own. But the Gemara assumes that if you want to give somebody a gift, and it's what we call a schuz gamer, it doesn't have any downside to it, so then one can assign a gift to another person, and that other person doesn't have to know about it. Because we say, Zachem lo yadam shelo b'fanav. So how that works, does that work on a level in our Torah, does it work on a level in the Rabbanan, is a discussion. But you want to glean from there, okay, that if I want to provide something for something else, for somebody else, and it's a clear zchus, so then it's as if I'm entitled to do that. So then if that's the case, what you could say is that you're not saying two different things. You're saying the same thing. You're saying that there's Kabbalah. And Kabbalah could either be explicit or implicit. You're saying that when the patient is awake and conscious and can choose among his doctors, so then we require that he actually do so. But in a circumstance where he has no option, he can't speak for himself, and there aren't other doctors to go to, there's only one EMT who happens to kind of chance upon his accident, and he's got to make a decision in the next 5 seconds, so then you could say, well, there's an umdra. You could say that there is essentially a premise that we can all agree to, that anybody in that circumstance would grab it, whoever's there.
Is that the same thing as that?
So that's not necessarily the same thing as Achim, but it comes from probably a shared yisod, that there's basically an umdun here, the same way we assume that anyone would want this. So too, you could say, maybe this is what Chet's saying, that anyone would want that this EMT should step in and help, because it's an emergency situation, there's no alternatives, and to just say, skip it and let him die, nobody would choose that option. So therefore, we can take it as if this person accepted. It's a form of acceptance. Maybe you're not saying two things. You're going to then expand it into that. Okay, so then happens to be, I think there's a different way to say it, but let's keep it within the original comment. So what do we see so far? So either we see that Kabbalah is a key element. The client has chosen to enter into this professional relationship, and therefore, that becomes some kind of a exemption from any kind of consequences. Or we found what Arye said, that he's going to be liable if he's not doing what he should be doing. So why is he not liable if he is doing what he's doing?
Why should he? Why?
Why is he liable if he is doing what he's doing? We should be doing. Why is he not liable if he's doing this? But your point was the reason he's chayiv when he's chayiv is because he's poshea. If somebody is if a doctor is negligent, he comes in drunk or whatever, or he doesn't read the charts and he just goes ahead, so then, okay, he's poshea. That's why he's liable. But what's the other side of that equation? So why is a doctor not chayiv when he's not poshea? Right, so in the laws of Nezikin, do we say you're only putter, you're only chayiv for damage when you're posheya? Is that the case? To a certain extent, there's a relationship, but it's not the whole story. It seems like we need to fill in that part of the puzzle a little bit more.
We can't just say that it's not explicit acceptance, but anyone anywhere who goes to somebody and asks them to do their job, and that's implicit acceptance up to the non-negligence aspect of it.
Maybe. So then, okay, then you're basically saying you agree with Jed, and you're not... we could certainly merge the two answers, right? We could say that Jed would also agree that it's a combination of the ideas, that I'm accepting you to be the guy to do this, but when I'm accepting you, I'm also assuming you're going to do your due diligence. I'm not accepting you carte blanche, that it's your job now not to come in drunk or to fail to read the charts. So if you do that, I revoke my acceptance. I'm premising my acceptance on the expectation that you're going to act responsibly. So theoretically, we could merge all the ideas together, and I think there's also somewhere else you can go with this.
I mean, like, how would Ornish fit in? Like, let's say it wasn't his fault, it was just like...
Okay, so now that's opening up another possibility. Okay, so let's talk about that. So maybe you could say, in order to also define two different svaras here, right, not necessarily put you all into the same bag, but keep Arya separate, you could say that it's true that when it comes to mazik, we say that Adam HaMazik is chayiv, somebody who causes damage to something else is liable, and we say Adam Muad La'olam, that a person is always considered to be Muad, he's always responsible for what happens, and therefore, even if it's not intentional, it's still his liability. And certainly, if it's negligent, it's his liability. But some of the Rishonim discuss that even though we say Adam HaMazik Ba'onis is chayiv, that somebody is still liable for something he does without choosing to do it. But maybe there's a limit if it's onus gomer, mamish. He had no control over the situation at all, no responsibility. So then that's just life. You know, sometimes people find themselves the unwitting kli where somebody else is lost, but they did nothing at all to put themselves in that situation. And there was nothing at all they could have done to change it. So then maybe we should say that in that case we would exempt the person. We would say you're potter. So maybe one could say that when a person is a professional, right, because part of the question is, should whatever exemption we're talking about, should it be limited only to a professional of a certain qualification? Right, which is a little bit what we're seeing in our Gemara, right? We're distinguishing between mumcha and non-mumcha and the like. So maybe we should say that when a person is qualified in training for what he's doing, and he's not negligent, so then at a certain point you can't blame him anymore. You can't say that there is any responsibility. So essentially, HaKadosh Baruch Hu decided, so you have, if you have a patient comes to a doctor, and the doctor is the best trained doctor in the country, has the best degree of anyone, and is completely attentive, does everything he should, pays attention to everything, reads all the charts, gets a good night's sleep the night before, does everything he can, and the patient still dies, right? It happens every day. So what does that mean? It means that that's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's plan, that the patient was going to die. It means that there was nothing that this human being could do that was going to change that, which again happens every day. So when those are the facts, that there's nothing you could do to have a different result, so then essentially you're not a mazik. You're just the tool in God's plan, but you're not in any way connected to what happened if there was nothing else you could do about it. So perhaps that's the yisod here, that when somebody is at a certain threshold of qualification and a certain threshold of attentiveness and responsibility within this specific task, so then maybe they're exempt for that reason because they are essentially completely not responsible for what happened. Morty?
Wouldn't that not necessarily follow for like being a judge? Meaning that would definitely work for being a doctor where there's an opposing force, like sickness or illness or damage that you have to compete against, so sometimes that will win out and you do the best you can. But when if you're a judge, then you have two people in front of you and there's not really any competing forces like making you make the wrong decision. I mean, there are competing
really?
Interests, but you're deciding between those interests, and you should be doing that objectively.
Except that it could be that there are facts you haven't been able to draw out. It could be even that there are...
Couldn't then you be allowed, like, a re-judgment? I thought when we
we haven't gotten yet to what exactly is the distinction between different kinds of mistakes. That's going to have to be something we're going to have to flesh out. But before we come on to working with those distinctions, so it certainly could be that there's elements of the reality that you were not able to discern, or maybe even that there's a Torah component that was just too complex for even the greatest scholar of the generation to be expected to know or to appreciate. And therefore, within that context, maybe it's imaginable that there could be an objective mistake at the same time as even the most prepared person couldn't have known differently. So, that might be the case here as well. It could be that essentially there's a point at which we're basically talking about onus, and that's what we have to work with. Well, we'll end in a minute, so what I would like you to do, since again a lot of you saw the Gemaras, but didn't see so much the Rishonim. So when you get to see the Rishonim, soon before we talk about this next, hopefully, so I'd like you to try to think about these possibilities that we're trying to draw out now and try to see if you find them within the Rishonim. But let's mention just one other idea that I wanted to also perhaps draw out, maybe from what Jeff was saying before, that maybe there is... another alternative way of interpreting what you said before, that if this is a good thing to be doing, and it's clear that this is the best thing you could be doing right now within these circumstances, you should be pater. So maybe there is a halachic way to formulate that. It's separate from what we've heard so far. That maybe there is an idea that there's a certain amount of protection, indemnification to somebody who's carrying out a positive act, whether you want to call it a mitzvah, a rescue mission, that maybe that comes with a certain amount of protection. If you carry out this mitzvah responsibly, you are going to be exempt from harm that you will impose. There might be such an idea. So, for example, there is a phrase that appears in the Gemara in Bava Kamma, which we're going to have to discuss what it means, because it's a little bit tricky and could easily get misapplied. But there is a phrase, mazik perishos. So I want to be careful with this because I don't want this to be misunderstood. And actually, it's a little bit timely because it's a Purim topic. So we have a leap year, so Purim is still a ways away, but it happens to be a major Purim topic. But the idea of mazik perishos sounds like it means that when somebody is pursuing a mitzvah, then they are exempt if in the course of that mitzvah they also damage something. Now again, I want to be very, very careful how to say that, because that could be easily abused, but there's some basis for that in the Gemara and Bava Kamma, as we will talk about. So it could be that you could have such a concept here also. Then maybe we should say, again, that this person isn't stopping doing things for fun. He's pursuing a rescue mission. And that part of the recognition of that rescue mission should be that he shouldn't be responsible for harm that comes from that, at least within certain limitations. So there might be some basis for that, as we'll see. So we'll just end off by noting that here's some synergy, that in this week's parasha, so there's so much that's covered in this week's parasha. One of the things that comes up is the phrase "Verapo Yirape" in a place called Einstein, used to be part of Yeshiva University, has a medical journal, an halacha journal, with that title "Verapo Yirape." It's from this week's parasha. So the Gemara in Bava Kamma says that this language, when the Torah says "Verapo Yirape," the Gemara has this, perhaps a striking comment. For all of those who venerate the whole institution of the Jewish doctor, So you think, of course, what could be more Jewish than being a doctor? And if the Gemara has the statement, V'rapoh yirapeh, mikan, this is better, at least than we were discussing the other day about the Mishnah and Tosha Rav and Gehenim, but still, maybe this is surprising, and the Gemara says, V'rapoh yirapeh, mikan, shiesh rishus l'rofe l'rapos. You see from here that there is permission granted for the doctor to heal, for the doctor to practice his trade. So many ask, what are you talking about? Obviously there is. Right? Isn't it a mitzvah to be a doctor? Aren't you doing something very holy? Aren't you doing something which we admire and which we endorse? And which even the Shiloh and Poskim, how can a doctor charge for his services? It's pure mitzvah. So why would I need the Torah to tell me that it's mutter to do, that it's a rishus? More than a rishus, mitzvah. So here you have a couple of approaches. And in general, to boil it down, you have a philosophical answer and you have a legalistic answer. So the philosophical answer, you find Ibn Ezra talks about this, others talk about this. You say that maybe someone would take the attitude and say, look, if this guy is sick, if he's suffering, so that's God's will. God wants him to be sick. So who am I to interfere? What right do I have to try to heal someone and try to thwart God's will? So to that, the Torah says, Chas v'shalom, don't take that attitude. God can take care of himself. You can't thwart his will if he doesn't want you to. There's no such thing. And this is the way he set things up. He gives people problems, and he gives other people a mitzvah to help them. He gives a mitzvah of chesed, poor people you're supposed to give stucco to. You don't take the attitude that God wants them to be poor, so who am I to interfere? Adarava, you try to help with providing stucco. So, if that's the case, So too. So maybe that's a philosophical approach, that you shouldn't think people are sick, it's God's will, leave them alone. Chas v'shalom, it's your mitzvah to try to help, and it's rishos and chova, and it's a mitzvah, but first we have to tell you that it's permissible, that it's not a theological problem, and then it becomes a mitzvah as well. So that's the philosophical approach. The legalistic approach is you can say, listen, you're a doctor, a surgeon, what's a surgeon going to do? He's going to cut somebody up, right? He's going to do all kinds of violent-looking things to his patient. So what in the world justifies that? The guy's a mazik. He's coming with a knife and cutting open his body. He'd go to jail. Why should we allow that? So we're so used to it already, the question doesn't even occur to us, that we assume, no, because he's coming to heal the person, so no one thinks that this guy is a violent slasher. He understands he's a doctor. But that's not so obvious, right? You might think, I should sue this guy. So we need to first acknowledge that what might otherwise be seen as an act of hezek or an act of chavalah, when it's through the pursuit of refuah by a qualified mumcha doctor, is not seen as chavala or hezek, but is seen as refuah. So this all contributes to the subject, that there's this concept of mazik rishus, that when somebody is acting rishus, and we talk about rishus in this context where he's been gemara, we really mean more than rishus, we mean mitzvah. We mean that he's been given the go-ahead by God, or the request by God to go do this. So then that insulates one to a certain degree. So maybe that's what the Gemara means, v'rapo riape, b'kan sheyesh rishus, the roof and the rapos, that the doctor is functioning the rishus, he's on a mission from God to do what he's doing. So therefore, the civil law consequences that could have emerged from what he's doing are going to be seen within that lens. So to hear, maybe that's the way of reformulating what you said before, that the EMT is a mazik rishus, and therefore, within certain circumstances, he should be indemnified.
How does this relate to a judge?
So this could, all these three svaras that we just suggested could relate to a judge. So we mentioned before that, I guess we'll stop here, just recap, And I'll recap this point in a second. So what I'd like you to do in Seder, most of you have seen the Gemara, but not necessarily seen the Rishonim. When you see the Rishonim, keep an eye out for when any of these three positions that just emerged from our discussion, see if they show up in any of the Rishonim and to what degree. So basically, question about that?
So you're saying surgery is, in a sense, mazik rishus?
Could be, yeah. Right, or it could be that the act of surgery itself is mazik rishus, but it could also be that if there is any actual loss to the patient through this process, that's the hezek that comes berishus, that comes through doing this action. Again, mazik rishus is a very loaded term, so I want to define it more next time, but just be aware the concept exists. So, just to recap, so we said a few more words about Dayin Yechidi. We talked about the possibility that when the Rambam says the Hodah is not a Hodah, maybe he only means for certain limited consequences, Meirit says, and that since the reason we normally don't validate a person's Hodah outside of Bezdin is only because they don't want to tip their hand before their day in court, but if the Yachid Mumcha is their day in court, so then we should take seriously what they said. But in the Hanami, it's a question of what the Rambam means. We noted that Gershuni pointed out that for the Rambam's language, you see that the obligation to set up a court system is not satisfied by Yachid Mumcha. You still need to have a system of three Dayanim. And then we noted a little bit the different interpretations of Ein Dayan Yechidi El Alpha, which we had assumed, like most assumed, that it's a reference to Kodesh Baruch Hu, but we saw other possibilities, like the Rabbeinu Yonah quotes, that it means only Yachid Mumcha does this, and you're presuming yourself to do that if you try to judge by yourself. Or this other interpretation from the Sefer Yad Yisrael, where it suggested that it means in order to be an effective dying, you have to see things only one straight way, and a human being can't really do that, only Kodesh Baruch Hu to do that, so you need a panel of three instead to have this process effectively. Again, very unusual interpretations. Then we started talking about what effect Kabbalah does have, that we know from the Gemara. We saw the Gemara says it's going to help if there is a toast. So we just tried to sketch out the territory, and we asked, what should the rule be in general? If somebody is a professional, and he's dealing with a client, and there ends up being a hezek or a loss of some kind to this client, so should he be liable or not? And essentially, through your suggestions, we saw three different ways to look at it. We saw, on the one hand, the perspective that there's a Kabbalah, that the people who are going to professional are doing it willingly, and therefore they're accepting whatever the consequences are. And then we had to make a caveat that if, let's say, it's an emergency situation where they're not actively accepting it, but still the presumption is that anybody in this situation would take this option as the only option, that's also an implicit type of Kabbalah. There's one way to look at it. We focused on the idea that maybe there's a certain type of onus at some point, that even though somebody is liable for things even that they don't try to do to hurt someone else, but maybe there's still a limit to that, that maybe somebody who has gotten all the education he can get and taken all the care he can and still is a problem, so then that means the problem is simply not his fault and he should be exempt. And the third possibility we mentioned is that maybe when somebody is pursuing some type of a mitzvah, so then maybe, we say this very guardedly because of the possible misapplications, when somebody is pursuing some type of a mitzvah, so maybe that also insulates them against the consequences. That is a sugya in Bava Kamma and elsewhere to look at about mazik rishus. And then we just noted a particular relevance to this week's parasha that the pasuk says v'rapo yirape, and the Gemara says v'kan sheish rishus l'rofe l'rapos. So we ask the question, why should there be a need for permission? It's obviously a mitzvah. Why should there be a license for the Rofe to do what he's doing? So we mentioned there's a philosophical approach that you shouldn't think you're thwarting God's will by trying to heal the people who God has made sick. But also there's a legalistic approach that one could think that you're essentially being mazik this person, being chogel this person. Why should that be legitimate? So we have to first explain that when one is pursuing a fuah, so then that could legitimate approaches that might otherwise seem like they're assault, and that could also have implications for how even unintended consequences might be viewed in terms of the mazik rishus. Probably not insignificant that this word rishus now is appearing in both contexts, probably to perhaps point us in that direction. Okay, so we'll stop here again tomorrow. Packed Chumash Day, major synergy in the Parsha, so be ready for that. And who wants to daven for us?